Welcome. This is the Lifetime Cash Flow Through Real Estate Investing Podcast. This is where you'll learn strategies to help you achieve lifetime financial freedom through real estate investment. Your host, Rod Cleef, has owned over 2,000 homes and apartments. And he brings experts in all aspects of real estate investment and management onto the show. Now, here's your host, Rod Cleef.
Guys, I have some exciting news. Since launching our podcast, and it hasn't even been a year yet, we've had over 1 million downloads. I got to tell you, I'm so very grateful to you guys for your amazing support. During that time, I've spoken with or met or corresponded by email with literally almost 1,000 of you, and I can honestly say it's been an incredible joy for me. When I released my book, How to Create Lifetime Cash Flow Through Multifamily Properties, more than 6,000 of you signed up to receive a copy. Well, today, I'm excited to announce that within a few weeks, we'll be launching what I can humbly say is the best multifamily training and coaching program available anywhere. We've carefully designed our program to include a comprehensive online course, coaching, accountability, motivation, an online members area, tickets to a live event, and we've packed it with a ton of other valuable tools and resources designed to help you quickly crush it in this business, to help you get to lifetime cash flow as quickly as possible. Now, if you'd like to receive some information on this when it becomes available, text the word CRUSH, C-R-U-S-H, to 41411. All right, let's get to it. Welcome to Lifetime Cash Flow Through Real Estate Investing. I'm Rod Cleef, and I'm thrilled you're here. And I know you're going to get a ton of value from the gentleman we're interviewing today. His name is Victor Menashe, and he has a new book entitled Magnetic Capital, How to Raise All the Money You Need for Any Worthy Venture. He's actually raised over $300 million himself for numerous things like corporate buyouts, ventures, real estate projects all across America. And he's a real estate investment expert, developer, and we're lucky to have him on the show. Victor, thanks for joining us.
Great to be here.
So I always like to ask, you know, where you got your start. And as you know, my listeners are multifamily real estate investors or aspiring multifamily real estate investors. So maybe you can gear your response to your involvement in the real estate arena, because I know you also do a lot of work in startups and things of that nature.
Well, I got my start, in fact, in technology.
Okay.
You know, I started out as an electrical engineer designing chips for telecom and various applications like that. So, you know, that's a non-traditional path to being a real estate investor, that's for sure.
Yep.
And what I did from there is got involved in the business development side and, you know, raising money for startup companies. And then it was around 2008, I decided to take a left-hand turn in my career and move into the world of real estate investment.
Interesting time for you to do that.
It was an interesting time.
Great time, actually, for you to do that. I was reeling from pain at that time, but great time to get into the business.
It was. You know, I was still doing work on the technology side. I had a VP of engineering role, you know, designing chipsets for data cards, and I was traveling to Japan every 2 weeks. So it was absolute burnout, and simply made a decision at that point in time to move into the world of real estate investment full time because I saw it as an opportunity. And I started out raising my own, you know, using my own capital. And like anything, when you're using your own money, you run out pretty fast, especially in real estate. And then I remembered, I said, oh yeah, Victor, you know how to raise money, and had to resurrect that skill set from the previous life, but now adapt it to the world of real estate investing.
Okay. And so you got into investing, and then it looks like you honed in on the raising money piece of investing, which of course is probably one of the most important pieces other than finding great deals. So I'd love to dig in, just hone in on your knowledge and valuable advice regarding raising money, actually going out there and finding money. And I know you go into it in great detail in your book, and I am a short way through that. I'm not finished by any means, but what I've read so far has been fantastic, so I will recommend it.
And thank you.
So I know that you like to talk about five elements of raising money. Do you mind expanding on that for us?
Of course. What I discovered as I was raising money for a variety of different projects, there was a pattern, almost a set of unwritten rules, that if you follow them, raising money is remarkably easy, and when raising money got difficult, it's because one of those elements was missing. And almost think of it like a pair of shoes. You know, it doesn't matter. You can go to the store, you can find the most beautiful pair of shoes, and oh my gosh, it's your lucky day, they're on sale. But if they don't fit, you're not a buyer. It doesn't matter how lovely they are or how deeply discounted they are. Mm-hmm. And if you think about investing that way, it takes a lot of the pressure off. It makes it so much easier to engage with investors because all you're really looking for is that perfect fit. And if it's not a perfect fit, don't do it. So when you look at the fit, it breaks down into these five elements. Number one is relationship. Most people are not going to part with large amounts of their hard-earned cash with someone they don't have a relationship with. And so it really starts there. And when I relationship, I don't mean networking. I don't mean any of those other utilitarian terms. It's really got to be genuine relationship.
I see. Okay.
Number two is trust. It's foundational. And trust is not just, you know, is this an honest person you're dealing with? It's a whole bunch of different things. Like, do you have alignment of intention? If you don't have that alignment of intention, it's going to be very difficult to trust. And then the third element of trust is so important that it actually is the third element, which is a track record. Show me your results. But before I go on to the third one, let's dig into trust a little bit more. It's a whole series of questions like, can you put together a good plan? Can you execute the plan? Can you hire the right team? Can you communicate transparently? Will you communicate when there's a problem? All of these different elements, and if any one of them is missing, it actually doesn't work.
Hmm. Oh, that's good stuff. Okay, so that's trust, and now let's talk about track record.
People want to invest in folks that have a demonstrated track record. Show me that you know how to be successful. Show me that you know how to make money. Show me that you know how to lead a team. People invest in businesses. They don't typically invest in the self-employed. So they want to see the track record, not just for yourself, but for the folks that you've surrounded yourself with. You've got to be part of that larger team because that's where it has sustainability. If I'm away for a week on the beach, I need, you know, my investors need to know that the projects are continued, that things are not coming to a standstill because I'm out of the office. There has to be that sustainability. And so much of the real estate world, especially real estate education, is focused on the do-it-yourself model. I think we're actually doing people a disservice because at the end of the day, business is a team sport. It doesn't matter what, you know, what the business is. It's always a team sport.
Couldn't agree more. And especially commercial real estate. In fact, you know, it's such a huge advantage versus single family real estate. The fact that you can put a team together, and when you're out there raising money and borrowing money, a team approach is a fantastic way to go about it because you can supplement your deficiencies in, you know, different areas of financial areas and credit and things of that nature by other people on your team. Experience, of course, you can supplement experience. So now I'm a huge proponent. I think I did a whole segment on team once, but super.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. And, you know, one of the questions I often get, especially from rookie investors, is, well, how can I raise any money if I don't have a track record? How can I get a track record if I can't raise any money? I'm stuck. It's a catch-22.
It's such an easy answer. It's go out
Absolutely.
There and find the track record, you know. And I tell people,
exactly.
if you can't qualify, find a sponsor. Find somebody that's got similar property that in hopefully near the area where you're interested in buying. Even if you have to give up a big chunk, do that first deal, and then you'll have a track record, you know.
Exactly.
And so that's what's so great about this particular business, multifamily real estate. So that was the third. What's the fourth, Victor?
Number fourth is you've got to have a compelling opportunity. Now, that's always a little bit in the eye of the beholder. You know, some people say, okay, for them, you know, 10% rate of return is compelling. For me, it's not. You know, some people specialize in a particular asset class. If, you know, maybe they only do medical office buildings or maybe only industrial or whatever. It's got to fit within that definition of beauty that is in the eye of the beholder.
Oh, love it. Love it. I'm going to quote you on that one. That's awesome. No, that's great. And the fifth one. And then I want to ask you how you go about qualifying a prospective investor. But so I don't want to lose sight of that question, but what's
sure.
the fifth one?
And the fifth one is alignment. And alignment is really all of the other elements of assessing that perfect fit. And alignment breaks down into about another 7 or 8 very specific criteria. So it's things like, what is the size of the investment? What is the length of the investment? How long is the money going to be tied up for? What's the rate of return? What is the security? What is the risk? What's the control structure? What is the tax consequence of the investment? and on. There's about seven or eight of them. And if you don't have a perfect fit on those elements, it's going to be very difficult. And oftentimes it's seductive because it looks like you've got a majority fit and it's not enough. You actually have to hit on all of those.
No kidding. Perfect fit. Well, that's very sound advice. So let's talk about how you go about making sure you have that perfect fit. Do you have any information in your book about how to begin that conversation or how to make sure that you're aligned? I'm big on checklists. Is there anything like that, or maybe you can speak to it a little bit?
It really starts with a conversation with the investor and asking them what they are looking for. The more sophisticated the investor, the more rigid they're typically going to be on what that criteria are. The less sophisticated investors don't have those goals as clearly defined. So when you know what that investor is looking for, for example, I have someone who is a long-term investor. He knows that if his money is at work, he's making a return. If the money's sitting on the sidelines, it's earning essentially zero. So he wants to put his money in. He'd like to keep it in for 5 years, and he wants it working. It doesn't have to be the highest rate of return, but he always wants it working. That's his criteria. Of another investor that wants to turn their money every 6 months.
Right.
I'm not going to give my 5-year guy a flip, and I'm not going to give my 6-month guy a long-term hold. It doesn't make any sense.
No, so, that's very important. So that's super. Any other high, really big criteria that you might suggest getting answered in that initial conversation, besides the length of the hold?
Oftentimes, the biggest question that comes up. Well, there's different class of investors, but one question that often comes up is the question of risk. Okay. And risk together with security defines safety. And let me break that down into what that really means. So risk is what is the likelihood of something going bad? The security is how secure are you in the investment? So let's say I'm a lender, I'm a 10% loan to value. I really don't care what the risk is because I'm extremely secure.
Sure.
If I have to foreclose, I'm going to get my money back and then some. If I'm at 90% loan to value, then I'm going to be assessing the risk much more closely because the combination of risk and security is a lower factor of safety. So you got to look at the two of those together.
Okay.
The second one that often comes up, in particular when you're dealing with larger money, is the whole question of how much money are you putting to work. When you're dealing with very deep-pocketed investors, their scarce commodity is not money. Their scarce commodity is time. So they have a certain number of deals they can do in a year, and they may have an investment minimum. It might be $5 million, might be $8 million, something like that, where if it's anything less than that, it's not worth their time and it's not worth the paperwork.
Mm.
So oftentimes you're dealing with a situation where you might be presenting something that's simply too small, and the conversation ends up being something of the form, well, how about we do a small get acquainted project or something like that just to see if there's some way to create a fit. But if there isn't that fit, move on. Don't waste people's time. Don't try and create a forced fit.
Oh, good advice. Good advice. Any last comment on that, on the fit, or? Those are the big ones.
Those are the big ones. I guess the other thing is if once you know what the investor is looking for, you actually have a fair degree of latitude in terms of how you package your investment offering. Now, if you're doing a syndication and you're bringing in 10 or 15 investors, you're not going to do 10 or 15 different private placement memorandum. It doesn't make any sense.
Right.
You're going to put everyone under a single model. But you might have two. You might, for example, have a debt offering, and you might have an equity offering. And so for the debt offering, you figure out what the sweet spot is for the investors that you're working with. You do the same thing on the equity side, and you try and get a best match for that. And there will be folks for whom it doesn't fit. And if it doesn't
for my listeners, yeah, just so that they understand what we're talking about here. So an equity offering would be raising money for the down payment, the renovation costs, all the out-of-pocket expenses, and typically getting financing, but not always. Sometimes you can just totally raise equity and purchase a property cash using equity. But now debt offering is, and so in an equity offering, that your investors have a piece of equity. So like, in, for example, in my funds, we offer a 50% equity position, and our goal is to refinance in 5 years, get a return of capital to our investors, and they stay in with that 50% equity position even once they've had their capital return. So that's an equity investor. Now, debt investor would be just like it sounds. They're acting like a bank. They're loaning money to the investment at a rate of return. They don't have an equity position, and they're just looking for a rate of return secured by real estate. So let me ask you a question, yes. Victor. Do you find it, I would guess that you find it's easier to raise equity than debt. Is that an accurate statement?
Not necessarily.
No?
No, not necessarily. Okay. It's up to the individual.
Okay.
You know, some people are interested simply in a rate of return. And so let's go through the whole capital stack here.
So my listeners understand that statement. A capital stack is all the money needed to consummate a transaction, from the equity to the debt. What else is in there, Victor?
So we'll start at the top with what's called the senior debt, and this is typically the bank debt. It's called senior debt because it's in the first lien position. If you go back through history, what that meant was they were typically first to get to the county recorder office to get their lien, the mortgage, recorded on title. And so that's the senior debt. They're in first position. They have the most seniority and basically the rights. They're first in line
They're
the most protected.
Right.
The second lien position, if there might be secondary debt, sometimes a vendor take back or seller financing will be in second lien position. Sometimes if you have debt investors, they might be in second lien position. And in banker terminology, they sometimes call that mezzanine money.
Right.
Or they might abbreviate it. They may call it mez. Mm-hmm. So if you want to get familiar with the lingo and someone says, you know, I need 10% mez, that means that they're looking to raise 10% in that second lien position. And then finally is the equity, and that's, you know, the banks are typically looking for the principals in the project to have skin in the game, to put up equity along with the other investors. Mm-hmm. And that percentage of equity is something the lenders typically look hard at as part of the safety for the project.
Okay. And so guys, what he's talking about here on that capital stack as well is, you know, I know you've heard me, or maybe you've heard my interviews with a couple of the people I interviewed, where they actually were able to get a seller to carry a second mortgage, and were able to get into I remember one kid I interviewed in Michigan, I forgot his name, but he purchased a $1 million property for $5,000 down because he got the seller to carry a second. He closed it, you know, right near the first of the month, and the bank agreed to it. So he got into a very low down situation. He had a relationship with the bank, if I recall. But so that's the capital stack.
Correct.
Okay. So next question, you've been known to talk about what people do to actually repel money. Can you expand on that a little bit?
This comes into the realm of almost human relationships. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if you think about the traditional relationship, maybe you know, a couple get together, they go out on a first date, maybe, you know, they get spend time together, they long way down the road, they maybe get married, start a family. That's a natural process that takes a long period of time. If you try and accelerate or skip steps in that process, you go from a very natural progression to creepy in a heartbeat. And so my advice is don't skip steps, because if you skip steps, you're going to creepy. And
so what
creepy,
are those steps?
Don't force it. Simply don't force the progression of the relationship. You know, for example, if I'm meeting somebody for the first time, I'm not even going to talk about business until maybe the sixth or seventh meeting. Now, if they bring it up sooner, we can accelerate it, but I'm not going to push it. This is not hunting. It's more like farming. You really
need
to nurture
that.
It.
Love that. That's a great analogy. And you're absolutely right. We all hate those people that, you know, the first thing out of their mouth is, hey, I'm doing real estate deals. You want to invest? You know, you've got to develop a relationship first. You've got to develop trust and rapport. And I'm not sure I agree that you have to wait till the seventh meeting, but hey, if once you've established a relationship. They know what you're doing, but it's very subjective. And you're going to know, you know, if you trust your intuition and you're a decent communicator, you're going to know when you can bridge that or discuss, you know, something of that nature. And you're right. Don't short circuit that process. Okay. Well, that's great.
And look, sometimes the investor themselves is going to accelerate the conversation. I had lunch one time with a gentleman who had just moved here from Africa. He had a lot of money. He came in on an investor visa. He was flush with cash and looking to put it to work. Took him out for lunch on my sailboat. After lunch, after we barbecued some chicken, he said, okay, down to business. So I say, okay. And so we got down to talking about projects, but he set the timetable. I didn't.
Okay, that's great. That's a great tip. Okay, so the next thing you're known for talking about is to raise funds but not ask for money. Could you expand on that comment?
When you ask for money, it almost seems like you're desperate, and desperation is never attractive. I mean, the women in the audience will relate to that instantly. So don't appear desperate, number one. And so I really don't ask for money. What I do is I offer people with whom I have a relationship an opportunity to collaborate on a project. That's a very different posture.
That's a whole mindset difference. And,
exactly.
And, okay, and that's great. So you offer people the opportunity to collaborate on a project if they're interested. You know, if you're interested, great, let me know. If not, great, let's have drinks.
That's exactly right. Because at the end of the day, it would in fact be disloyal to someone with whom I have a meaningful relationship not to offer them the opportunity.
I love that. Love that. You're doing them a disservice because you've got this incredible opportunity, and if you don't tell them about it, then how would they ever know or be able to capitalize on the opportunity? I love that. And that's a great attitude to take about this, guys, is you have an opportunity, and if they don't want to take advantage of it, absolutely no problem. But if you don't tell them about it, you're doing them a disservice. Love it. Absolutely love it. So how do you invest like a billionaire if you're not? I know that's something else you talk about.
Here's the approach that we're taking for a lot of our developments. You know, there's a large group of investors out there looking for deals. And my attitude is that most great deals are not found, they're created. And there's a very big difference between the two.
Okay. I want you to expand on that for sure.
If you look at any multi-unit project that's out there, you know, that's 250 units and above, anything that's appearing on the market today, if it appears on LoopNet, on the commercial MLS, there's going to be multiple offers. It's almost a fact of life today. I mean, I placed an offer last year on a 496-unit complex in Tyler, Texas, and there were 20 offers on the property. I never want to be the winner, you know, with 19 other bidders, unless, I know something the other 19 don't.
No, or unless you've got a track record and can prove you can deliver. And, you know, I've had people on the show that have been in that environment, Grant Cardone being one of them.
Sure.
And just convinced the seller and the broker to accept his offer, which was less than the other offers, because they knew he could close. So that would be the only caveat to that. But I agree with you. It's a frenzy right now, and I really believe the sweet spot is in the smaller stuff. But continue.
That's exactly right. What we focus on is finding opportunities where we can buy right. I mean, you've heard it many, many times. The money is made in the buy, not necessarily in the sale.
Right.
So you've got to buy right. What we do, if you think about most cities, they have this dividing line. It's usually typically right outside the downtown core. There's going to be a hot neighborhood that's been, you know, really gentrified. There's lots of cafes and art galleries, very walkable communities, lots of neighborhood restaurants. And then you go two blocks too far and you're into the hood.
Know it well. Talk about it regularly. And there's some incredible opportunities there. So that's what you're talking about with creating value.
Absolutely. So what we do is we go just on the wrong side of that line. And now that line has to be movable, meaning it can't be a municipal boundary. It can't be a freeway or something like that. That line has to be arbitrary. If you start to develop on the wrong side of that line, you can literally buy on the line and move the line.
Right. Love it. Love
now,
it.
you can't just do one or two. That's not enough for the marketplace to take notice and say, oh yes, the line has moved. You've got to put a little scale behind it, or maybe invite other developers, other partners in, so that there's a lot of development going on around you. And if you do that, then you can literally convince the marketplace. You know, we're developing right now, for example, in Philadelphia, where we're in exactly that situation. To the south of us, we have the Fairmount District, which is a fairly expensive neighborhood. You know, a townhouse in that neighborhood will typically sell for $500,000. You go one block north, that exact same townhouse is going for $280,000.
Wow.
So in one block, if I can build new product that is comparable to what's in the Fairmount District, I can get appraisal values that are very close, maybe not 100% of the Fairmount appraisals, but I'll get pretty darn close because there's nothing to the north of me that is a comparable. So the only comp that makes any sense is the one from a block away.
Wow. Wow.
So when you do that, you create tremendous value. You know, you talked about a model where you're taking money, you are returning capital to your investors, mm-hmm. And then keeping them in the long term for the deal. That's exactly the same thing we do.
Mm, good.
Now, what we do is we focus on capping our investment at 70% of what we believe to be the ultimate appraised value. So when we have that 30% lift, that 30% value add on top of our cost of construction, it's very easy once you have it leased up and stabilized to go back, refinance, pull your chips off the table, pull out all of the cash, and you're still sitting on maybe 25-30% equity, which is a reasonable ratio, but you have no cash tied up in the deal. Now you can take that capital, redeploy it, do it again.
That's a great business model. That's a great business model. And that's a sophisticated business model. And you've got to have a good team put together. You've got to have a great general contractor. And you're actually building from the ground up, or are you converting?
Yes.
Okay, so that's a pretty sophisticated business model. It might be a little too much for some of the people that listen to my show, but you know, it doesn't mean to say you can't ultimately do it. And if you put the team together, a team that has done it, you can absolutely do it. How many units are you doing in that particular project that you just referenced?
Right now, we have 4 10-unit buildings under construction right now as we speak.
Fantastic. So, oh, and same general area?
Yeah, all within, you know, like a 3-block radius. Yeah.
So you're moving the line yourself.
Correct.
Wow, good for you. That's very impressive. Well, listen, Victor, I'm very grateful that you were on the show, and you've definitely added value. And guys, check out his book, Magnetic Capital, How to Raise All the Money You Need for Any Worthy Venture. And is that on Amazon?
It's not on Amazon yet. We're actually doing a formal launch in May. They can order it from magneticcapitalbook.com.
Magneticcapitalbook.com. Awesome. Well, I definitely think there's going to be a ton of value in that book. And, Victor, I'm very grateful to have you on the show.
It's been my pleasure.
All right. Take care. Thank you.
Thank you. Take care.
Thank you for listening to the Lifetime Cash Flow Through Real Estate Investing podcast. If you've enjoyed the show, please subscribe and then take a moment to visit iTunes and leave a 5-star rating and review. For more resources to connect with us further, please visit our website at lifetimecashflowpodcast.com. Tune in next week for our next show.